Welcome to the Central Question Podcast, where we explore the craft of creative nonfiction, hosted by Sean Prentice and Jessica Hendry Nelson, co-authors of Advanced Creative Nonfiction, A Writer's Guide, and Anthology from Bloomsbury Publishing. As always, Anna Clara McGrath, our producer and a student in the MFA program at Virginia Commonwealth University, joins us.
Hi, so today in episode 5, we talk with Kristen Miadas-Young about her essay, A Few Thoughts While Shaving, and about chapter 7 in the textbook, Narrative Energy. First, a bit about Kristen. Kristen Miadas-Young is the author of the novel Subduction, which is a finalist for 2 International Latino Book Awards in 2020. From 2018 to 2020, Kristen served as prose writer in residence at Hugo House. Her prize-winning investigations, essays, and reviews appear in the Washington Post, Literary Hub, and Guardian, and elsewhere, as well as many anthologies. She was the researcher for the New York Times team that produced Snowfall, which won a Pulitzer Prize. And from 2016 to 2019, she was board chair of Investigate West, a nonprofit newsroom she co-founded to protect vulnerable peoples and places of the Pacific Northwest. Welcome to the Central Question, and welcome, Kristen.
I'm very glad to be here.
So, hey, Kristen, just to start, I was wondering, would you tell us a little bit about the essay's origin story? What was the impulse to write it? And in what, in your mind, is the essay's central question? What is it really asking?
So, you know, when I wrote this essay, this is one of the very first personal essays that I wrote. It was actually the second personal essay that I wrote. And wow. I wrote it in a class, actually, with Luis Alberto Urrea, who was kind enough to blurb Subduction and has been an incredible literary mentor and supporter of mine. But I was in this workshop with him because I was at the Centrum Port Townsend Writers Conference, where I also teach as afternoon faculty, but I sometimes take the morning workshops with these greats like Luis. And, you know, it's funny because up until this moment, I think I had always believed that an essay or a piece of fiction that needed to emerge like Athena from my brain, split me open, devastate its surroundings, and leap forth, you know, without any impetus, right? With an immaculate conception in some ways. But this particular essay, we were in this class, and Luis has a very different teaching style than the ones that I had encountered at my MFA at UW. And he takes out a cigar box full of pieces of whatnot, keys, you know, stars. There was so much in it, but they're all like very small little cheap trinkets. And he passed it around and we were each supposed to take 2 items and then write an essay or a short story based on it. And most everybody in the class wrote a short story. And I wrote 2 things. I first wrote a short story that actually was published in the Los Angeles Review recently called Try Saying Yes. And those were based on 2 items. It was a very cheap ring where the ends did not meet. And then there was a star, which gives the rather memorable first line of this essay. And so, you know, in the fictional treatment of those items, the ring was a wedding ring and the star was just that. And in this essay, it becomes the tight star of my asshole, right? Which gives what he called a little Joan Jett opening to the essay. But of course, you know, a prompt is not enough to dislodge your life's experience. I think that what was really breaking forth was the idea that I could talk or write about this affliction of my body, which is a cancer that I had, borderline tumor, when I was in my early 20s. And I had been told by my family never to discuss it publicly and never to disclose it publicly because of their worries that I would be not hired for positions or that I would be not allowed to sign up for insurance. And so it was meant to be a very private happening. But of course, like all irritations over time, you suck them long enough, you can make a pearl. And I realized that this energy that comes into this essay is in part the energy of the long dissimulation about my own bodily experience and feeling the need to bring it forth into being in such a way that provided me with mindfulness over the emotions that it caused and also connection to those very same emotions so that I might move through them and come to what I hope is the result, a yielding to joy.
That's beautiful. I love it's. It's really lovely to think about moving from the object of a plastic, a cheap plastic ring, and that star to that really evocative first image. And, you know, I do wonder, one way I think about essays beginnings, I start with image, often start with image. And so I'm just wondering about that leap from the star to the, I mean, was it as simple as that? Like the one evoked, the star evoked the image of the asshole, or was it, you know, more of, you know, that meditative, what was it about shaving that felt like the right sort of frame for this meditative essay?
Well, I think many times women are criticized or demeaned for the rituals of self-care that we perform regularly. Impossible, of course, to criticize my choice to remove hair from my body as being a submission to the patriarchy, one which supports gender norms and ethnic ideals of beauty to which I do not conform. And yet the truth of what I have known of being a woman is that these rituals, whether shaving or putting on makeup or applying cream, provide some of the only moments for reflection during the time, many times in our lives, but particularly this one where, you know, in the shower with me is my toddler who is, you know, not really walking at that point. Actually, it's not quite a toddler, but kind of sitting there and kind of emptying and filling a yellow bucket as I shave and think about the movements of my life. And that processing, that emotional self-given narrative is both ritualistic in that it's soothing, in that it kind of brings you into yourself and helps you understand who you are. And it's also a preparation, a summoning of the life's experience so that one might face the rest of our existence here on this beleaguered earth with a bit more courage and strength. And so the frame of shaving, of course, it gives the action. You move from one leg to the next, or depending on what you're shaving. But it also is literally just the time that a woman has to attend to the meaning of her own life. And that time is in the in-between time. And so unlike, let's say, the idea of a flaneur who's going to be walking the city streets, and I've written other essays that have been anthologized, which are about just that. But in this particular phase of my life, multitasking, having extremely deep intellectual and emotional inquiry that is happening at the same time that I'm shaving my body and watching over a baby is the truth. And so the truth of the multivalenced presence that a mother and intellectual must bring to her life in order to occupy its various stages is the reason that I chose that frame.
That was really well put. And also the ministrations of the body work so well with the content and the ideas that the essay is circling. So I think it's actually a really perfect frame, and even more perfect because it's so unexpected.
Well, there's very few essays, unfortunately. I mean, we have The Argonauts, right, as a book-length work by Maggie Nelson. But in terms of considering the topography of a pregnant woman body, as a site of valid scholarship, as a locus for originating intellectualism, is something that is fairly uncommon, and especially uncommon when considering the other intersectional concerns, whether those be socioeconomic or otherwise. And so when I look at why women have or have not brought these kinds of actions into their work, I think it's fear of being seen as being domestic.
I would agree. I think that that's really interesting. And I think that, I wonder also if it isn't a concern about being like vulgar, like you mentioned, or being like revealing some part of yourself that's not. You mentioned sort of the opening sentence and how it has that sort of like the tight star of my asshole, this like very direct line. And I wonder if that's also like part of it, like just like even just like admitting that we shave our legs or something, you know, is some kind of, I don't know. I wonder about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, for, you know, millennia, women have been taught to hide the fact that they have an asshole, even though everyone has one, you know, as though discussing something that we all possess or even making a oblique reference to it, you know, would somehow denigrate us. It's a collective enforced delusion.
And what I find so interesting is we're talking about narrative energy, and what we're talking about right now is this frame and this, you know, we were talking with Ira Sukhrirang recently about how we live in our minds as writers. And that's really what this essay is about. It's about not the tension of shaving. Of course, there's a tension there, but really what the tension is here is about you dealing with cancer and your family dealing with cancer. And then you have that child and you're wondering, will you be able to keep writing? And I was just wondering, can you talk about how you worked on that tension and keeping that spread throughout as you go about the process of shaving and watching your son?
Well, I mean, the thing about discussing the cancer that has run through my family in the context of being pregnant and minding a child while also trying to be a writer is that the impediments to the continuation of my creative production are many. I could die, right? Or I could pass on cancer through my breasts, which I make reference to, you know, them swelling and suckling and letting golden drops fall as my body prepares to for the second birth, you know, and with those drops comes the possibility, right, of this intergenerational transmission of a genetic code, which may or may not yield cancer. And so the tension is about whether or not I will be able to write, but also am I passing death on with the gift of life to my children? And although that is always true of any mortal, that we pass on the end with the beginning, to know that it could be foreshortened by something that is particular to your genetic code is sobering. And when I consider the question of being able to write or not, part of it is also making the decision to spend my earthly time on this act, which cannot in its completion yield the same kind of joy as watching a child. Like, the act of writing is beautiful and cathartic and transformative. And yet it's also a bit grim. It's a bit enduring. You have to endure the process of creating something, and to create space for that endurance is to deprive time of others so that you can dedicate yourself to this task. And so with so many responsibilities and expectations of one person as a mother, as a daughter, as a writer, as a journalist, you know, as a community member, that the question of will I have time or won't I is not just about motherhood, but also about the foreshortening of my own life and the gendered expectations of what I will use my time on earth to do.
So I want to ask follow up what you just said with a question that's a little more localized in the text. Because I think, you know, you do this in a really precise and nuanced way on a line level. And you do that through what I think of as dialectical movements. And we talk about that in this chapter, which is really the tracking of the writer's mind across different but related ideas. It's almost like, you know, a skier changing direction while traversing down a mountain, which simultaneously increases speed, increases narrative energy, but also control over that speed. You know, if she heads right down the mountain, she'll go really fast, but it won't be as interesting or nuanced than slicing back and forth down the slope. And in fact, you'll cover far less area. And so the voice in this piece is really dialectical. It's really digressive. Here's a very small example. After there's a short paragraph in which the narrator is a child and is accused of using her mother's surgeries to get extensions on deadlines for turning in papers at school. And you write, "Nothing sharpens the mind like a deadline. That may be why I'm so productive while pregnant. I will not give up on this manuscript despite fatigue that settles over me like fog. I have to sit down midway through my showers. Good thing there's a bench." And I just love that progression, you know, from the childhood narrator, the idea of nothing sharpening the mind like a deadline, and then moving back into the sort of visceral, tangible, corporeal world of being in the shower, sitting down, good thing there's a bench, you know, that digressive movement. So could you just talk to us a little bit about that choice throughout the essay. It happens again and again. That's just one small example. But to use your digressions to sort of circle these ideas, almost like circling a drain, which makes sense given the content.
Well, I think about what, for this, I think that the endings of each of the paragraphs or of each of these sections before it goes into a bit of white space and lands again in another space is very important. That conclusion of that paragraph to land that line, nothing sharpens a mind like a deadline. And then to allow some white space so that the reader can comprehend how many different deadlines I'm referring to. One, the deadline of turning in a manuscript, the deadline of a pregnancy and a birth, the flattening of one's heart rate into a flat line connoting death, the possibility that not only will this birth bring about new life, but it could also bring about my death, and certainly a surgical intervention. And so Jane Hirschfeld mentioned that endings should reverberate in the body of the reader, that resonance is necessary to create an engagement that lasts beyond the reading of the piece. And so by providing a little bit of white space after each one of those concluding moments of a paragraph gives the reader a chance to kind of assimilate all of these various references I'm making simultaneously. And it makes it much more poignant when we come back into the text, often landing in a different space-time in my own life. And so for that, the white space was incredibly important. And the idea that every single time I made reference to something which had been invoked in the essay already, that reference needed to gain further purchase on the material. It was not a repetition, but rather an incursion into deeper meaning through that recurrence.
Well, and sticking with the idea of white space, you're talking about, white space from paragraph to paragraph, but you also have it from section to section. And you have these big, massive jumps. As an example, you write, "Get a wedding ring on your finger before it's too late. The good ones get gone and what's left is damaged beyond repair. Or maybe that's me." And then we have a complete white space line. And then you write, "Will I have time to write or won't I?" And we have these massive jumps in ideas. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how you work on the transition, because though they're massive, this essay flows really well.
Thanks. I think that, thought is kaleidoscopic. And when people read an essay that is tracking the natural movement of thought in a writer's mind, they are able to make those leaps with the writer because our minds are associative. The idea of a linear function is a legacy of Judeo-Christian norms. And so moving out of the idea that to build meaning there needs to be chronology means that you use poetic juxtapositions to create tensions in between images and dialogue and statements on the page that allow for a feeling to be created. And that feeling is more important, I think, than the facts. Now that this essay is entirely factual. All of my nonfiction work is entirely factual, and I work very, very hard to always be accurate. But what Tim O'Brien, of course, called the story truth is more important than the happening truth. So it's not necessarily important for the reader to know how much time has elapsed between when I recorded that experience of having the tumor removed when I was in New York and in my first internship out of college at Time Magazine. It's not important for them to know that it's been, 10, 15 years. The amount of time isn't important. What's important is that the past continues to be present. And that knowledge that we carry our past with us, regardless of whether they've been disclosed and regardless of how much time has passed, is something that I think creates a connection with the reader. I remember seeing a statement by Louise Glück about, she said, "We look at the world but once in childhood, the rest is memory." And that felt so true to me. And yet so much of our adult lives are meant to spend parading around our expertise and our accumulated knowledge without recognizing that our emotional story truths of our childhood are actually often guiding and shaping and even controlling the way that we interpret what we see as adults.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that is really smart. I'm thinking about, what's the name of that story, How to Tell a War Story, that Tim O'Brien story that's so good about that kind of like the narrative impulse. But I'm also wondering, just thinking sort of as I'm listening to you talk and thinking about these white spaces, another writer that was coming to my mind is, I don't know if you've ever read Jenny Odell, who wrote Department of Speculation. She's a fiction writer.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how, you know, she also writes in that kind of very sparse style. And I know that I've heard in some interview with her that she was talking about, like, when she became a mother, she just didn't have time to like sit and write these like long paragraphs anymore. So it was just like, she had time for two sentences. So that's what she had time for. And that was sort of the nature of, so it became that her writing was the more minimalist because she just, it was the time that she had to spend. And I'm wondering if that's something that it, like, that it's, if it's particularly well suited for an essay which deals with motherhood, which deals with pregnancy, to have this kind of like this more white space, this more sort of a patchwork kind of style.
Well, I do believe that time does create its own meaning. And so if you have a limited amount of time, it can be certainly easier to write an essay or a discrete piece of creative nonfiction than it is to finish a full length novel. I, of course, was doing both at the same time, right? Like when I turned in my second draft of Subduction, when my first son was born, I had submitted it to my readers and I put that novel through, actually, I'm gonna hate to disclose it, but at least a dozen more drafts, full drafts, between then and publication while also mothering the two children. And so it's certainly possible to work on longer form. And this, of course, I'm conducting investigations for The Guardian at the same time. I'm, you know, helping to lead the nonprofit and mentoring other writers at Hugo House, doing all those different things. But the almost psychotic self-belief that is required to pull off a book-length manuscript when you are so strapped for time can be very difficult. During that time, reaching for other forms can give you the sense of accomplishment that it can be harder to have when you're wading into and out of a manuscript without having brought it to closure during that period of time, no matter, even if you were able to bring together some midnight hours to work on it. And so certainly I think that being a mother has shaped the time that I have available to offer to my writing. But I would also say that, and this is something that I didn't anticipate, being a parent has driven me deeper into my own humanity and has made me become comfortable with myself, my own body, my own narrative in a way that I did not have to be when I was not yet a parent. And that is not to say that people can't get there without the experience of mothering. It's just one of the things that brought me here into this space of self-acceptance. And, you know, in the essay, of course, I talk about acceptance as being a necessary precursor to love. And so really the essay is about learning to love yourself despite countervailing winds. And the ways that I find to bring that into the text are through almost cinematic depictions of moments of high emotion in my life. And yet the undercurrent, this very strong tidal movement within the essay is of drive, right? The drive to finish a manuscript despite motherhood. The drive to keep going despite the exhaustion of the body. And that is something that any parent and many non-parents will be familiar with. When your will is an animating force that can actually defeat the mind. But of course, there is no defeating of the mind, right? The mind will cycle. So even if I would have meant to use that shower time more fruitfully to be thinking about working out character engagements or dialogue or plot or figuring out something with my longer manuscript, what I have noticed, these digressions are actually incredibly powerful because they allow for things to burble forth which had been suppressed. And so not only mothering, but also writing a novel drove me so deeply into my own psyche that I had almost no choice but to write personal essays. I had to write them, and I continue writing them to these days.
And I love that how you're writing these personal essays, it's form follows function. It's mirroring exactly how you in that moment are thinking and able to process the situation around you. So I just find that really beautiful, the way the essay on the page matches what seems to be your life lived in that moment.
It's accepting yourself. I mean, part of it is that, you know, another current in the essay is aging, accepting what some people could see as a deterioration of the body, but also could be seen as the fruition of the body. Understanding that the marks that I may have on my face or my body now are symbols of survival, you know, and learning to accept those rather than trying to erase them both in reality and on the page. And so kind of that reckoning, right? It's a reckoning with our own mortality in the context of our continued dedication to society and the self. And for me, I have continued to write in the collage style because I find its associative leaps to be so fruitful. And many times when people try to overly explain something that they would like to convey, they kill it. Right? They kill the meaning because they have tried to fix the meaning. And in the case of this essay, a lot of my other nonfiction and also the fiction, by allowing ambiguity, by allowing play within the reference, you expand the world of incorporated meaning, and the essay really just gets bigger.
I speak about that with my students a lot. I think about the role of play in process, especially in essay writing, but you know, certainly in all forms of writing, but there is something so essential to, in my process, in my making of essay, to the willingness to play, to not, to be lost, to get lost, to circle, to come back. And I'm wondering, you know, just for your, is that true in your process too? Do you know when you begin an essay, do you have a sense of where that essay is headed? Or do you discover that along the way?
For whatever reason, my essays require many fewer drafts than my novel did. It may be that I taught myself to write over the decade that I spent, or 15 years that I spent on the novel, but I'm much closer to completion upon completion of the first draft than I am in fiction. And I think part of it is that I'm telling a story that in some ways I've already mastered in my mind. And so conveying that truth takes me less time. I did not know how the essay would end. I do like to, there are two, so Mariam Toews, who's a really great writer and wrote a book called All My Puny Sorrows. In that book, she also wrote a book called Women Talking. It was just absolutely fantastic. But in All My Puny Sorrows, it's about this, one of the characters is a musician and she's explaining to her sister what art can do. And what she says is that an ending can either deposit you back safely into yourself, right? Comforted, assuaged, maybe deepened, but also essentially you're left back in a safe place. Or that an ending can leave you naked and shivering in the woods in a state of great perturbation, trying to reckon with forces that are beyond our control. And so my essays tend to do one or the other. In this particular case, there is that upward lilt towards the joy and meaning making that deciding to live, deciding to mother, despite knowing that I may die, despite knowing that I will die, that my children will die, and I don't know the cause, despite knowing that becoming a mother could be an impediment to the thing that I want the most or had wanted the most before, which was to be a writer. Making that decision is tremendously affirming, and I make it for myself, but others, when seeing it, can also be affirmed. And so it plays a little bit into the idea of bringing someone who has been put through a tremendous emotional maelstrom into a place of safety before the end of the narrative. But of course, all the lingering questions, will I be able to write? Will I pass on cancer to my children? You know, will there be a space for me in my own life? Those remain unresolved, but what the reader does know is I am committed, and they can feel that commitment through the narrative, and so are probably comforted in some ways. They're probably not really worried about whether or not I'm going to be a writer, or really worried about whether or not my kids will have cancer. They just feel this connection that I have bearing a child in my body at the same time that I'm with another child, and simultaneously crafting this piece of creative nonfiction. And so that simultaneity that I manage in life and on the page, I think offers an example or a demonstration of what I am capable of doing so that the reader feels comforted. However, there are other essays where, you know, you come to the end of them And I've sent you several examples that you could have chosen from, and I'm glad you chose the one that you did, but leave you in a state of a shaken state. And I think that's equally valid. If that's the, that affirmed, but also disrupted state is where I aimed the ending of my novel to be. And it's something that I think is important to do. Otherwise, we essentially are imitating what I consider to be a legacy of long dead white men, which is a structure that oriented around conflict that always, you know, ends with a kind of gymnastic dismount into resolution. And I think it's better for some works to have work still to do in the mind of a reader when the narrative concludes, that there is not, the meaning has been prescribed. The meaning has been gestured toward, but not delivered as a neat packet.
I agree with that. And I would also, I would maybe argue that the ending here is, while it is, there is some soothing to this ending, it also leaves the reader a bit shaken too. I think that those contradictions still exist, even if the gesture is one, is a hopeful one. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all that comes before, all of that, all of the fear, all of the uncertainty still exists in this ending. And that's what makes, I think, a really viable ending, these contradictions just being allowed to be, you know, what we call in the book, the knot of meaning, which is not one truth, but you know, contradictory truths that the writer is asking the reader to accept as equally true, that they are irresolvable in the end. And I think this ending accomplishes that beautifully.
We as women have always been told to flatten our narratives to conform to expectation. So I think it's actually, this form is uniquely suited to the complexity of women and what we can offer in terms of holding concurrent meanings simultaneously, which may be in contradiction. So thank you for that.
Right.
Well, the other thing I loved is this whole chapter in our textbook is about narrative energy, and we talk about it within the chapter, or sorry, within the essay. And what you're talking about right here is about the narrative energy at the end and how it should be like a bell struck and it should just keep ringing and ringing. So that's a great way to end that idea. And as we move towards the ending, we always ask our writers to give us a writing prompt. And you mentioned one from Luis Alberto Urrea earlier, which was an amazing one. And I'm wondering if you have another one you'd like to share with us.
Well, to me, I have found that creating lists in some ways of recurrence in a life can be very helpful to structuring an essay without creating a box for it. So I would say to pick an object in your periphery, and it could be anything. It could be right now in front of me on my desk. I have an iron key that was given to me in a ceremony at the end of a writing conference. Picking any item that is in your life and writing a series of scenes that are different sections when that item or object recurs, and finding connections between the constellation of people and landscapes that item comes back into your life can be done retroactively, right? But just beginning with choosing of an item and then tracking its recurrence in your life over time.
So Kristen, thank you so much for talking to us today about this essay, A Few Thoughts While Shaving. It's one of my favorite in the anthology, and just reading it again in preparation for this interview, new things revealed themselves to me about this essay and why I love it so much. So I encourage our listeners and our readers to read it once, twice, three times, four times, come back to it, because there's so much there about craft to be unpacked. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really, you know, when someone selects just the title of this anthology has done a lot for my writerly self-assessment. But when I think about the work that goes into putting together an anthology, the thoughtfulness of your narrative frame for each of the chapters, which is so different than other textbooks that I have seen or treatises on writing that I've seen, I'm deeply grateful because I know that both of you are stellar writers. And so to give of yourself as an editor in this way is a true generosity. And because of that, I also want to give a shout out to Jacques Jenk, who was acting as nonfiction editor at Hobart, who selected this essay for publication in July of 2017. When editors lift one's work out of the dark and into the light, it can change your life tremendously. And I would say that publishing this essay, performing it repeatedly on various stages throughout the United States, and now having it selected for inclusion in this anthology have changed my life. And so I'm thankful for the work that you've done and to the readers who will read it.
Kristen, we're so thankful for you and your time and your writing. And thanks so much to the listeners for joining us today as we explore the central questions of creative nonfiction. Please rate and review the central question. And feel free to follow Sean and Jess at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Also, don't forget you could buy our textbook, Advanced Creative Nonfiction, and visit our website for more resources. Have a great day and keep essaying.